It's The Wonky Show. What would it mean to put student rights at the heart of higher education policy? That's a question a new paper from the Post 18 Project is asking this week. We've got fresh details of how the LLE will work under this government. NSS results are in, and we're asking if universities are walking back from their civic commitments. It's all coming up.
So this is not about how institutions can think about improving the student experience, laudable as that activity is. This is what it's saying, no, this is what students are entitled to.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and here to dissect the week's developments as usual, we have three fantastic guests. On campus, it's Chris Millwood, Professor of Practice and Education Policy at the University of Birmingham. Chris, your highlight of the week, please.
I think my highlight of the week is the announcements on the LLE, which we're going to talk about, which I thought very clear and give us a lot of things to reflect on how regulation and funding can change.
And in Hendon, it's David Jarney, Head of Student Engagement and Advocacy at Middlesex University. David, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, it's got to be merry National Student Survey season to all who celebrate. It's the results yesterday. Wonderful day being able to go through all of the feedback and data that's come through from students, both here at Middlesex and at the national picture. Always a fun day of the year.
And live and in colour from Wonky's HQ, it's David McVitty, Wonky's editor. David, your highlight of the week, please.
I think highlight yet to come. We're having a dinner for our friends across all the political affairs and communications and external relations work in universities together with our partners Public First this evening. So it should be a very jolly occasion, and hopefully we will make it home a little bit earlier than we did this time last year.
Right, so we start the week with Doing Better, Getting Better. Debbie, tell us about this.
Yep, this is the latest output of the Post 18 project, the sector's newest space for thinking in different ways about what's going on across Post 18 education. This is a new essay from Wonky's own associate editor, Jim Dickinson, very, very, very well known to listeners of this podcast, who has pulled together all of his thinking about the student experience into a very hard-hitting set of proposals for what students should be entitled to in the contemporary world. And I think there's so much in there. And if I were to start going through it, we'd be here sort of till midnight. So I think there's a kind of few things to say to kick us off. The first is that this is Jim's proposition is that we need to not say goodbye to the idea that there will continue to be a full-time student experience. So we are sort of seeing a bit of fragmentation, I think, of this thing that we sort of traditionally think of as the full-time student experience, because students are working, because students have complex lives, and because it is hard to fund what we think of as that traditional experience. That doesn't mean that lots of students won't still want to sign up to study courses full time. So Jim is thinking through, okay, well, what does that actually then mean? How do we think about the totality of that experience? How do we recognise, that students may need to engage in paid work? How do we think about how healthy they need to be and how their health can be supported? How do we think about the communities that are formed in this larger, more complex, more diverse world? But that still has this core idea of a full-time student experience. So that's the kind of first thing Jim is trying to do. The other thing is that, this won't come as a surprise to anyone who knows Jim, is that the lens through which he's taking this approach is very much a rights-based framework. So this is not about how institutions can think about improving the student experience, laudable as that activity is. This is about saying, no, this is what students are entitled to. So he's suggesting that students should be entitled to safeguarding and safety, and that their institution should be accountable to them for that, that they should be entitled to pre-arrival questionnaire and transition support, that they should be entitled to a minimum income standard. And this is something that that government should deliver. And critically, that this is something that kind of needs to be coordinated across government, not just out of the Department for Education.
Right. There's a lot here. It's Jim's magnum opus been working on for several years. But the 10 foundational rights, I think I want to, David, which of those that jumped out at you do you want to talk about and kind of the context of what your work at Middlesex, which overlaps, I'm really conscious overlaps a lot on some of the Jim's themes here. And I'm going to take some of them and dive into them a bit more, but I want to see what jumped out at you first.
Yeah, sure. I mean, overall, there's a big theme through a lot of them around this idea of, as Debbie was saying, really enshrining in rights this idea of belonging and being able to engage as a full-time student at university. It felt like it was very much a philosophical argument from Jim that there should be the space that universities are expected and held responsible to provide for students to develop as people. And, I'm sure there would be critics who would say this is the old way of university, you know, where students were living on campus, were taking part in lots of extracurricular activities, had all of the time, you know, didn't have to worry about part-time work or caring responsibilities or commuting. And so we're given this space for higher education to essentially be discovering themselves and the contribution they can make to wider society. And I suppose the real challenge that we've seen on the ground for those of us working in the student engagement space is this idea that is becoming increasingly hard to be able to provide for students, because we're plastering up the wider systemic issues that students are facing in terms of that lack of funding and space, in terms of wider responsibilities they're expected to take on whilst they study. So there weren't many things in the report that I disagreed with. It's a wonderful list of things that would be great if students had. I suppose the struggle that I was seeing is, where is this going to come from? You know, there is a lot in there which is being asked of government in terms of funding, in terms of perhaps providing more rigidity for the sector. So there is a higher minimum threshold that we're providing for students. I think it's wonderfully aspirational. I think it's just when we get into the nitty-gritty of it, how much of it is going to be able to be proposed in the current political climate? How much of it is going to be able to be possible through collaboration across the universities? Where what I took from the report, and you know, Jim may disagree with this, is it doesn't seem like he's saying this can be solved by universities just having better networks who bring together and share good practice around student engagement, belonging work. It's got to come from the regulatory angle of saying this is the minimum that universities are expected to deliver, or we will hold them accountable for that.
One of the things that really jumped out at me, Chris, was the stuff about traditional assessment and how the rise of AI makes kind of essays almost obsolete, because the way that it can help you structure knowledge is the thing that you're learning when you're writing essays. What does this prompt in terms of, you know, what comes next in terms of assessment?
I think universities are already thinking about and implementing changes to the way in which they assess to account for the capabilities of AI. And it's there in guidance to students, but also in the way in which they're constructing assessments. So to give you an example, you know, my son is a second year economics student, and one of his assessments this year asked him both to produce an outcome using AI and then write his own and explore the differences between them. So universities are already thinking about how they can build this into the assessment, not least because graduates are going to be using this in the workplace. So they need to understand the capabilities and understand how the knowledge that they're developing through their studies can work with AI when they get into the workplace.
And Debbie, what about the democratic deficit that Jim talks about, and in terms of his experience from European universities and students having power in voting and governance, curriculum design, resource allocation, all these kind of things? Is any of that kind of feasible in the UK?
Well, I think it is really interesting how, you know, in the UK we sort of continue to work from what is fundamentally a sort of a model that students campaigned for and advocated for in I think the sort of 60s and 70s, around, I guess, the establishment of independent student unions, and then sort of and then student representation on key decision making bodies in universities. And in that sense we have this very robust democratic structures, but it is not, none of these things are, I guess, a right that students have. And certainly I think Jim's point is that they do not always deliver the decisions in the student interest, or the sort of level of kind of democratic empowerment, or indeed engagement, that we might want to see, or indeed that might kind of answer the challenge of young people in general feeling disengaged from politics and or, you know, becoming more sort of a sort of populist in their orientation. But I think what for me, I would kind of look at that question, and I think this is maybe something that is probably quite a live debate in the student union sector. I would look at that section in light of the section on community and connection, because I think it is very easy to sort of tinker with democratic structures and say, actually, we need this kind of representation. Actually, we need that kind of representation. But then to realize that unless that student who's representing in that way is embedded in a community of students from whom they can not just, you know, hear what their concerns are and sort of understand what their experiences are and represent that back to university, but also kind of mobilize that community as a sort of activist, you know, engaged, active group who are invested in the institution and who sort of have a sort of collective sense of their own interests in participating in the processes and decision making of that institution, and that is kind of a sort of open thing and something that is kind of seen as part of the learning experience. I think what you just end up with is, you know, some sort of rabbit in the headlights student officers doing their very best and you know, enormously overloaded. And so one of the things I think about this paper is that it would be a little bit hard to cherry pick its recommendations, actually, and a lot of the things that come out of You know, lots and lots of universities have really great transition support, right? This is something the sector has been working on, you know, for years now. Once it became clear that this was something that was necessary, lots of universities have lots of initiatives around developing student community and engagement. Lots of universities have, you know, as Chris said, are really, really thinking about what the implications of AI for assessment are. Jim's point is that until you codify a sort of baseline expectation here, and you do it across the piece as far as is feasible to do that, these things support each other. What you're doing is creating a construct called a student experience that is appropriate for the contemporary world.
I think that plays into one of the challenges. So does baseline mean, you know, codify across the whole sector? And is that what is being talked about across the whole of this report? Because there's just a vast number of recommendations and reflections here. So it's a great provocation to universities about changes in the student experience. And I particularly like the stuff in there about the kind of extended transition through life within which universities are a key part, and also the permeability with work and other modes of life. And I think that's a good provocation to universities. But what I just can't see is how you translate this into something that would become policy, because there's an assumption of a scale of government intervention that it's just not capable to do, even if you thought it was desirable for it to do.
But I think, to me, this is very interesting, Chris, because, you know, I think we have seen governments in the past that have, and, you know, it is surprising, I think, the lack of interest from government in the student experience. You know, if you think about the new Labour government and the Higher Education Act, you know, and the creation of OFA, the creation, you know, the creation of NSS, the creation of the OIA, you know, there was a real sort of sense there that sort of saying we need to think about students' experience, students' rights, and we need to actually start monitoring this. Like, you might disagree with any of those interventions but there was a government interest in the student experience. And I think that we're just not seeing that in the same way now. And I don't know whether that's because the framework has changed and the core relationship is sort of framed as being a consumer one between institution and student, and then that's sort of governed by that framework. But I think kind of part of the point is that this is an enormous constituency here, and the government should care about it and should kind of be thinking about it, even if not perhaps necessarily at the scale that Jim's proposing.
And this needs to come from the sector, doesn't it? That there's something about how, that, as you were kind of alluding to, Chris, I think, you know, that there is a lot in here about asking for greater regulation, perhaps therefore restricting choice across providers. There's something of saying this is the way we think we should have as a bare minimum for the student experience, which, you know, it needs to, if that voice is going to be taken by government, it needs to be coming as a willing request from the sector to say, yes, we know this will mean that universities might have to do things a bit more restrained because we're having to do things in a similar way in some areas, but that's something that we think is necessary to be able to create a system where there is more clarity in terms of expectations of what students can expect. And, you know, as I think you were saying, Debbie, there's something in the strength of the report about how much the recommendations tie together. You know, if you have the right to connect and to contribute and building that sense of community within universities more strongly, it's then going to make it easier to have democratic systems of governance where students are empowered to, you know, not just be consulted, but to be more central to the decision making, because if they are more invested in that community, they're going to be more willing to put in the time and effort to take ownership of where it should go next, because they're invested in it. And that idea of building that community is only going to be possible if you've got the right funding model in place so that students can actually afford to be that invested in the community. So you've got that strength of all of these different recommendations tying together. But I guess then on the other side of that, that's potentially the weakness of it, which is that if you pull one of the parts out, it then becomes very difficult to see how students would actually have the capacity across the whole sector, you know, not just those that are kind of well supported and funded before they go to university, to be able to interact and invest in the experience in that way.
And I think we'll perhaps say two things. I think there is a role for government around convening in this space. It's certainly the case in England that regulation has backed out of the space beyond measuring it through some of the things that published this week, for example, because there's a sense in which we establish a baseline and we let the market flow. In some of the other countries, the UK obviously has a different approach to this, and there's more interest in convening across a smaller sector and indeed a tertiary sector and focusing on themes that are important. So I think there is a role for convening, but I think in a way there's a step on from this report, which is saying, how actually could you make this happen? You know, let's identify some priorities where we would want to make progress.
I wonder if also there's something for me about what would a sort of, you know, because it's partly about one of the things that the Post 18 project can do. And, you know, this is, you know, for anyone who's not aware, this is, you know, this is absolutely brought to you by the people who bring you Wonky, but it has a different intent behind it, which is to provoke and to influence and to say the things that perhaps might be harder for the sector to say sometimes. You know, no sector organization is going to be calling for more regulation. That is just one of the things that's going to happen. So, you know, so to be able to kind of make those arguments and make those cases to kind of push the conversation forward. But I do wonder actually what is the sector's vision for the student experience actually? You know, because I think, you know, it is completely legitimate to say this is too much, this is too complicated. And actually, I mean, and that has internally, that is sometimes our criticism back to Jim, right? It's sort of say, Jim, you can't say that. It is too big an ask. Government is not going to suddenly start coordinating its kind of transport, health and local community policy around students. Like, that is just not a thing that's going to happen. And you need to stop saying you think it ought to, because, you know, it's becoming a bit tiresome. But, you know, there is, I think, a kind of a question about sort of saying, if you push the policy envelope as far as it can go, what's the backup? You've created more space. And then what does that vision look like? And part of the point here is, I think the sector is struggling to say, you know, it's genuinely struggling with some of the challenges articulated in this report. It is really, really difficult to engage students when their lives are this complex and they do not have a lot of money and their health is being harmed by the struggle. And they, you know, and they're not able to engage meaningfully in a sort of ongoing communal experience that from which they can then become active, democratically engaged citizens. You know, these challenges are real. So I would like to see, an inevitably more anodyne version, but also that the sector could get behind and say, this is actually, we do believe in these things, and we do believe that the full-time student experience is a thing that is worth protecting as a sort of social stage and as a thing that is of value.
I think one of the challenges there, Debbie, is what is the sector? We have in England, we have a massive sector now. So I would say my university, and I'm sure David's university, are individually really thinking about these issues and articulating them. But at a sector level, that is now very challenging.
Although I would say that I think, I don't know if it's just the way it seems to be coming recently, but there are seemingly more and more, you know, sector-wide projects that they're still opt-in, aren't they? In the sense that not every university has to participate, but building on from National Student Survey in 2005, since then we've had sector-wide projects launch around transition surveys and so kind of getting a better understanding of the student experience and how to respond to it at that earliest point. Ones around belonging. There's just, as of I think yesterday or earlier this week, announcements around sector-wide looking at module surveys versus NSS and the connections between the two of them. So there's in my head, there's kind of two routes. There's the policy, government, regulation, you must all do this. And so the sector has to be really up for it and ready for it, because once that comes down, that's then the formal way of doing it. But then there is the perhaps slower but still steady progress of sector innovation, of just the idea of collaborating across the space, knowing that we're all facing those same challenges around engaging students and wanting to be able to respond to the changing lives of students. I think that does still move things forward. It's just whether we're comfortable that pace of progress is fast enough for our students, or if it's not enough for what they need at this point in their lives and in their studies to best support them.
I think that's really true, and I very much commend the work that people like you, David, do in trying to drive that conversation forward, you know, both in your institution and taking part in those sorts of national projects. And I think one of the kind of, I guess, corollaries of that is perhaps that dialogue with government about saying, what's the framework that could help us not just put constraints on us, but enable us to move this forward. So thinking, mm-hmm. you know, and actually the sector has been very vocal about, for example, student maintenance and the inadequacy of the current settlement. But also there, I think there is something about saying, notwithstanding, Chris, that the sector is not, you know, a single voice, that there may be a case for saying, actually, the bits of the sector that do have influence is saying, actually, we do want to draw a line. We do think that there is a baseline, a standard. I'm not sure if it should be expressed that way, but, you know, we do think that something that is falls outside this space that we have articulated isn't the same. It may serve a different purpose, it may serve a different function, but it's not the same as what we're collectively trying to achieve here with the student experience.
I think that's quite challenging in a very competitive context, because mm-hmm. universities will want to say, the student experience in this institution is distinctive. Mm. There are distinctive features of the student experience. experience due to the character of the disciplines, the location, the nature of the learning environment, and the character of the students involved. So I think we've just got to be a bit careful about uniformity.
I think that's spot on, Chris. I mean, on the one hand, I'm an optimistic person by nature, and I do think that kind of institution collaboration has a place and does move things forward. But on the other hand, I feel like sometimes it's like a Sisyphus kind of esque trying to fight the system and the context that we're in. That there was a really interesting article in Higher Education recently by Vicky Bolivia and Loana Promenzio, which was all about basically English higher education now being hyper commodified, and that change over the last 15 years being nothing that they've seen in any other international higher education system. And there is something about that, students being seen as consumers, the way that we're positioning higher education in, it focuses on England, but kind of the UK more broadly. It doesn't set us up for that framework you were saying, Debbie, where institutions are encouraged to collaborate. Chris, as you said, it does mean that there is always going to be some reticence to that collaborative driving up of standards of the student experience, because people want to be able to hold on to what keeps their institution distinctive. So it's a real challenge in terms of how much we try to nibble around these issues by, you know, just working on the outside, or how much this needs to come from government and therefore sector change, because otherwise that type of institution and that culture that we exist in is going to make it just difficult to make as much progress as we need to.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Douglas Dowell, Policy Manager at the Russell Group. This week, I've been blogging about the value of international partnerships for our society and for our economy. We know that universities really value their global links, but we also need to show why they matter to the whole UK as well. To do that in a new way, JISC has analysed patterns filed at UK universities for us, and they found that our patterns are becoming more international and that we're working a lot more with businesses as well as universities. So drawing on that, we've published a briefing showing why international partnerships matter, producing better research, wider impact, and more investment for the UK economy.
Now, we've got lots more details about how the LLE is going to work. David, talk us through it.
Absolutely. Yes, it's been a big week for fans of the lifelong learning entitlement. Labour have finally moved on what this policy means in their context. The policy, having obviously been originally championed by the Conservatives, is now being reshaped. There's some things which I think we knew about before that haven't changed. So, for example, the overall timeframes, the timetable, learners will still be able to apply for from September 2026, of course, starting in January 2027. But a few things have changed since kind of the policy was talked about in the past under Conservatives. So one of the key aspects of the lifelong learning entitlement, the LLE, is the modular provision. And what Labour have confirmed is that this will now be linked to their industrial strategy. So only some subject areas will be permitted for that modularization. And there's certainly plenty of interesting discussion there around what that means in terms of what counts as being economically valuable and the inherent links to politics that will bring. There's also a decision made within the ruling, or kind of the news around this, that franchised modular provision will be excluded from the scope of the LLE. So that's going to mean something in terms of access and flexibility, especially for smaller providers, FE colleges, etc. And then there was also some interesting information within the announcement around the application process and the idea that there will be a simpler and quicker approval route for those universities that have got either TEF Gold or TEF Silver. So again, something interesting there in terms of potentially streamlining processes, but also raising questions around what the government is trying to do when it welcomes people into the LLE processes versus trying to restrict or ensure there's some form of quality control. So it's very interesting. I'm not sure whether those of us on the call, others who are perhaps more kind of familiar with how the changing narrative over LLE has come from the recent years, will be able to see whether this feels like something that could have always been the Conservative policy, or if you can see things which have definitely shifted with the new Labour government coming in and changing its priorities. But I think that's the main things of where we're up to so far.
Jackie Smith's been speaking about it this week.
We put a focus onto young people getting started in their careers, but we also need to make sure that people can continue to upskill throughout their life. So just today, in fact, we're publishing more information about how the lifelong learning entitlement will work, and that will enable people to upskill throughout their lives. It also, I think, drive change in the way in which higher education is offered across the country, and that's a really important opportunity.
So, Chris, do you think the minister's right? Is this going to drive a big change in the way we deliver higher education in this country?
I think it's best to see the LLE as a long-term shift rather than something that will have rapid results in terms of change. So it's in a way about putting the whole system on a footing that is more flexible to lifelong learning and shorter cycle learning. I personally think that they're right to be cautious about the modular element and bringing that in carefully and prioritizing areas for that, given risks of fraud and previous experience around that and the overall financial pressures. I think ultimately, if there's going to be a shift, it's of course not just going to be about finance. It's going to be about the broader supply of higher education. And there's a kind of gnomic reference in the announcement to clear accessible pathways and working with the sectors to develop that. And that feels to me really the key thing. So how can you create an environment in which FE colleges, universities and employers work together to create those pathways? And actually, I think that's more likely to happen at a local level in places across the country through partnerships of trust between institutions and mutual interest rather than kind of national rules. So the key issue is how does the government create an environment for that to happen? Obviously, devolution is part of that. But it's worth, you know, giving a mention to the EPI report that was out this week, which was about how nurturing collaboration in local areas is the key to this really making a difference over time.
So a timetable still on track, launching in 2026, starting in 2027. Debbie, do you think that's realistic for this?
Possibly. It depends on the sorts of things it depends on institutional kind of appetite to develop some of this modular provision. So I think, you know, the fact that kind of all the traditional courses can be funded through this mechanism and nothing really changes on the face of it, that's all kind of fine. If what we're talking about is rapidly thinking about which modules in the designated area of courses that relate to the industrial strategy might be something that would be worth offering on a modular basis, talking to the various stakeholders, seeking approval, and then I think kind of critically, some of the back office plumbing stuff about developing that transcript and, you know, what that output looks like, so that student can then have that in their hand and take it away, and for that to be kind of clear and feel, you know, and then to be able to sort of submit that to DfE and get the approval and stuff like that. That all does feel like quite a lot, but technically feasible if you're doing it at quite a small scale. I think what we won't see is this sudden explosion of modular provision across the country and in every provider. I think people will be thinking very carefully about perhaps what they want to kind of put into the market and test. And I think there is a question about whether, you know, what that market looks like for this kind of provision. Certainly any kind of piloting has not had a brilliant response, but of course pilots happen in a different framework. So I think, and I think I agree with Chris on this, actually. I think it is very sensible to do things to do things gently, to roll out, to test whether it works, to develop it further. And that's, I think, what the aspiration is here. It's not to say that no module will ever be accessible that is outside the realm of the industrial strategy, you know, forever and a day. It's about saying, well, let's start with these priority areas because we know we need more provision in that. And build out from there. And I think, you know, it'll be very much whether institutions feel that they can make that work as part of their overall strategic development.
I was just going to say, don't underestimate how good it is that a government is continuing with a policy launched by a previous government. You know, there is some continuity here, and that doesn't often happen. And also there is, I thought it was actually quite clearly articulated, trying to join up different elements of this, DfE, SLC, OFS, Ofsted. And that requires a lot of work. So I think quite a lot of thinking has gone into this.
I think also, I mean, my sense is that one of the kind of challenges has been a sort of a low level of trust, perhaps from the sector, that this would ever actually happen. And so it may be that, so my sense is that when I've been having conversations with people is that there's a, you know, they're sort of saying, okay, well, we see the value of this and we see how it might work, but we're sort of waiting for that steer from government. So the scramble to get things out the door may be more unseemly than had the sector had confidence in government to kind of deliver what it said it was going to in the first place. But that is also extremely understandable that there was a degree of skepticism.
Definitely picked up, Debbie, that there's other institutions, especially when they were doing work in areas like learning framework and kind of more of the setting up the structures for the academic year, were thinking, well, let's not put in place any changes that are going to make it harder for us to move into LLE in the future. But certainly not a proactive appetite to be ready to go for it from day one, because, well, until this announcement, I think there was still so much skepticism that it would actually go ahead. One line I did notice in the report that I found interesting was that the government planned to, in the section, how will we support the sector to deliver the LLE, there's one line which just says support trailblazer activity. So I think they might recognize that there isn't going to be this huge upswelling from all institutions, all providers to be ready to go for this from day one, but they want to make sure they can support the institutions who do want to make this a core part of their delivery or want to be on the front foot. What exactly that support looks like, I suppose, obviously we'll wait to be seen and will be interesting. But I think it's something which I haven't picked up, at least from conversations in the student engagement, learning and teaching space. All providers are ready to go and rearing to go from day one on this.
And I think, there's a difference as well, isn't there, between a bit of modular provision that is going to help meet a particular skills need in a particular area, that there's kind of employer buy-in and maybe, and all that good stuff. And it serves a need kind of on in and of itself, and the long-term aspiration of stackable modules that you can take at your own pace. What struck me was the maximum of 180 credits in a year is fundable, which would enable people to take more credits than the current full-time sort of standard full-time allows. That's exactly what LLE should be doing, right? You should be able to take it very, very concentrated, or you should be able to spread it out over a period of time. That comes with all kinds of challenges around curriculum building and making sure that the qualification that is awarded still is meaningful in the labor market and broadly in quality and standards terms. So all of that I think needs to be worked out, and there's going to be a consultation on credit systems. But I think really, there's been so many efforts to try and say we need to have a national credit framework for transfer, and actually saying something, okay, well, this is something that people have got in their hand that serves an immediate purpose in the labour market. Great. Let's try and understand what purpose that could serve in the continuing education landscape. And not be too kind of not trying to sort of define it too narrowly in the first instance, and just see what people need to be able to do with their credits, and then try and build systems to respond to that. That seems like a very sensible approach.
I can see three things in here. One is obviously make the finance available and explain it clearly, and start to implementing it, gradually opening up the modular element. The second is try and make the different regulatory influences supportive rather than an obstacle to it. And obviously that's substantially about the higher education space and how quality regulation works and access regulation works. And the third is, with whatever money you've got, try and finance some trials, some pathfinders that support collaboration between colleges, universities, and employers to see where this might work and build the demand. So those are kind of three ingredients.
And just not to establish conflict where it doesn't need to be there, but when I was reading through this, given we've just had the conversation around Jim's proposals around student rights, it did seem like there's something of a tension in terms of what's the future of UK higher education playing out between these two points. There's the idea of enshrining the full-time student and university having a purpose of giving students that space to find themselves, know how they want to contribute. And then there's the lifelong learning entitlement route, which is much more of the individual choice linked to economic value. And, there are certainly merits of both, and there are areas where they don't need to be in conflict at all. But there's something around the direction of travel that the government announcement of LLE in this kind of format looks like, which is more towards the latter. The overall objective is giving students that choice, as you were saying, Debbie, in some cases to be able to rush through more credits than they usually would be able to, as opposed to perhaps the other full-time students' arguments, which are around defending that time and space to not have to rush through and get into, quote-unquote, adult life faster, but to be able to really explore the kind of the wider student life that is there. So I don't know, given that we're discussing both on the podcast today, I thought there was something of an interesting comparison between the two.
Now, DK from the team is here to tell us what's in this year's LSS results.
So the 2025 iteration of the National Student Survey is out. Decentish response rate 71.5%. And the headline findings are pretty positive, an improvement on last year. 89.6% of students were positive about the quality of teaching on their course. There was also data relating to student characteristics. This suggested in particular disabled students are having issues. There was a concerning finding about students who had declared mental health problems being less likely to know about the university's support for well-being, and that's obviously an actionable thing. As is usual on Wonky, we've not done the whole league table, who's the best, who's the worst, who's improved on last year, kind of saying that we've taken a look at the sector as a whole in a number of charts, which you can look at performances against benchmark and such like that kind of thing. It's all there on the site. So rather than listen to me talk about it, you're probably better just going and have a look at that. Thank you.
And finally this week, a new report about civic universities suggests universities might be walking back their civic engagement activity. Chris, tell us what's going on here.
So I think there are two reports this week. There's a report from SHU, which is a little bit gloomy, worrying about, in difficult financial times, universities not financing partnership between with local communities. And then there's a more positive view from UPP, which of course been working on this for a long time, but it's the Civic University Commission, and work with Bob Kerslake, identifying the opportunities that arise from devolution, growth mayoral strategic authorities. There's a lot of coverage of this at the moment because, of course, the word civic is one of the five priorities in the letter associated with a fee increase a while ago. And so everybody is thinking, well, what does civic mean? And what do we have to do to show that we're making progress on that? I think there is an important issue about how we're defining civic here. Clearly, it's being defined as about place and location, but there is a broader conception of it. When civic universities like the one I'm in were founded, it was by local people and it was serving local people, but it was also intended to be a kind of beacon of science and culture which would project to the world. And it was also about nurturing citizenship, so in a way enabling people to use their freedom responsibly. And I think there's an issue about how we kind of conceptualize civic that we need to resolve if this is becoming part of the policy landscape. I worry that the perception in the SHU report is that civic is basically about a fairly kind of transactional set of activities where we broker between universities and local communities. If I think about my university, you know, civic happens through having a health and medical school, which is right next to the hospital. So it's completely integrated. It's about having a social policy school that's integrated with social services. That kind of more embedded approach is really the key thing, but it does need to be adequately captured and measured so it becomes a core part of research funding, core part of knowledge exchange funding, so it becomes embedded in what universities do. I think that's a much more kind of prosperous future for civic activity than assuming it's about a particular separate set of transactions.
Mm. Zebby, if it's true that universities are kind of quietly disbanding civic teams and some of this activity is kind of winding back, I mean, does this speak to this being more of a kind of cultural issue or a funding issue?
Yes, I think there's probably kind of, as ever, there's sort of two places to go from here, aren't there? There's the okay, so I think, you know, what there does seem to be going on, and the evidence is mixed, as Chris alluded to. You know, you have a number of roundtables, and some people say, "Oh, we're doing really well, we're doing loads of stuff," and then the other ones say, "Oh, it's all being eroded, and there's no money for anything." It's a reckoning, isn't it? A reckoning point, isn't it? Where you say, if the overall envelope that we have to fund this a sort of activity, or if we have depended, put it like this, if we have depended on our sort of sense of civicness as being on a discrete range of projects and partnerships and things that we're doing that are sort of always being framed as kind of additional and short term, and as long as the money holds out, it is therefore not surprising that some of those relationships and projects and activities would be scaled back when there is less money to disperse. And I think that speaks to perhaps a sort of not very mature understanding of how civic can be, you know, on the part of those institutions, potentially, because if you sort of set things up in a way that isn't very sustainable, then you end up with things that get cancelled. On the other hand, so I guess there's a sense of kind of there needs to be a maturing. On the other hand, I do, and this is something actually we sort of want to play out as a debate on the site on Monday, because we think it's really interesting, is about, you know, what does that maturing process look like? Can you, you know, if you're a university and you're saying strategically we need to weave this sort of sense of place and care for place throughout all our activities and our core mission activities, and also we need to make sure that we are very clear on what the value is, both for our place and for us. So we cannot just assume that setting up some stuff in a place has value. It's got to be this is about kind of finding common ground with our place, finding common purpose, and building on that through the research and teaching that we do. I find that a very persuasive argument, but I also question whether there are things that a community might expect of its university, or that a university might expect of itself, that is that you could frame in a kind of civic way that doesn't relate to research and teaching. So I'm thinking about procurement, for example. You know, thinking about local procurement and trying where possible to kind of buy local. Thinking about the role of the university as a local employer and the principle that you pay your employees a fair wage, a living wage. I think there are some things that kind of get put at risk if a university very consciously tries to embed its civic activity across its core mission. But optimally, this is about saying, let's have a mature conversation about who we are and how we resource this in a context where there is just less money to throw at lovely activities. This has got to be delivering on.
I think those examples you've just given, Debbie, are about strategic decisions by senior management and a lens on the benefits for the place and the responsibilities to the place with all of that. It's not about, a discrete set of activities brokering relationships. So I think it's still an embedded question. How do you do procurement? How do you employ local people? And that must be the way forward. I think there's understandable concern about the role of place in English higher education. There was no reference to place in the 2017 Act. So no recognition of the, profound relationship between higher education and place in this country from its origins to now. And of course, particularly, research intensive universities feel like they're in this kind of global world playing to global measures and global rankings within which international students and reputation are really key. So I do think it's a really important job to provide the right incentives for universities to think about how they support their place. But if that's going to work, it's got to be rooted in education and research and strategic decision making rather than being a bolt-on. And so that's where I kind of depart from the SHU report.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on walkie.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Walkie Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Chris, David, Debbie, and Michael Salmon for making it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay walkie.